Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, and thanks for joining the program today. In the third chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva says this: "Thus, by the virtue collected through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. May I be the doctor and the medicine, may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger, and during the eon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need, and may these be placed close beside them. Without any sense of loss, I shall give up my body and enjoyments, as well as all my virtues of the three times, for the sake of benefiting all. By giving up all, sorrow is transcended, and my mind will realize the sorrowless state. It is best that I now give everything to all beings in the same way as I shall at death. Having given up this body for the pleasure of all living beings, by killing, abusing, and beating it, may they always do as they please. Although they may play with my body and make it a source of jest and blame, because I've given it up to them, what is the use of holding it dear? Therefore, I shall let them do anything to it that does not cause them any harm, and when anyone encounters me, may it never be meaningless for him. If in those who encounter me a faithful or an angry thought arises, may that eternally become the source for fulfilling all their wishes. May all who say bad things to me or cause me any other harm, and those who mock and insult me, have the fortune to fully awaken. May I be a protector for those without one, a guide for all the travelers on the way. May I be a bridge, a boat, and a ship for all who wish to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek one, and a lamp for those desiring light. May I be a bed for all who wish to rest, and a slave for all who want a slave. May I be a wishing jewel, a magic vase, powerful mantras, and great medicine. May I become a wish-fulfilling tree, and a cow of plenty for the world. Just like space and the great elements such as earth, may I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. And until they pass away from pain, may I also be the source of life for all the realms of varied beings that reach unto the ends of space." The chapter these verses come from is headed "Adopting the Spirit of Awakening" in the translation by Stephen Batchelor. The spirit of awakening is, of course, bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and to develop this intention, we need a basis of great love and great compassion. Love, from a Buddhist perspective, means bringing happiness and its causes to those we love. But great love doesn't make a distinction. Great love is so called because it focuses not only on those close to us, but on all beings, including our foes. We have to develop the mind that sees them all as so lovable that we are willing to give everything up for them and to them, so long as it benefits them, particularly in their spiritual progress. That is why these verses are so important in our discussion, for in essence, they express our intention to become whatever other beings need to be happy, right up until enlightenment. In the text we are following, the author Namkar Pal quotes some of these verses to show us the kind of attitude we have to assume if we want to become enlightened. We have to be prepared to give everything up to others, even our body. So the practice which we've been describing over the last couple of programs is to visualize transforming our body into everything that others need and giving it to them as described in these verses. But now, before we continue, let's set a bodhicitta motivation for participating in the program as we usually do. Let my participating in this program become the cause for my enlightenment, so that I can be of greatest benefit to all beings and give them everything they want. Something like that. But if you think it's too much for you, then at least think of your own liberation from suffering instead. Thank you. Now, you may remember that last week we discussed how to give to those who are our enemies or to those who are harmful to us. Of course, these are the most difficult beings for us to have love for, but it's crucial that we do, for as we explained in an earlier program, the mind that distinguishes between beings in terms of friend, enemy, and stranger is quite destructive. We have to see all beings equally, as dear as our very kind mother, and develop love for all of them on that basis. As Namkar Pal says in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, having imagined creating various external necessities, such as food, clothing, and shelter from our bodies, we invoke all harmful elements with a hook of the awakening mind, then sincerely giving them whatever they require. Generate a deep sense of closeness to them, thinking, you've been my own mother on countless occasions over beginningless time. You have tried your utmost to help me in every possible way, saving me from misery and disaster. Remember that in addition, we owe them an immense debt, having eaten their flesh, gnawed their bones, drunk their blood, and worn their skins. We've robbed them of their possessions, tortured them physically, and taken their lives. We should recognize that we now have a responsibility to repay this debt of kindness. He continues, since this is their right, imagine they're obtaining what they each wish in their respective forms. Food for the hungry, clothes for the needy, shelter for the homeless, friends and servants for those who yearn for them. Of the foods, supply the three dairy products, the three sweets, and flesh and blood for those who want them. Give liberally without restraint. Let those who want flesh eat it. Let those who want blood drink it. Let those who want bones gnaw them. Let those who want skins wear them. Whether they want raw food immediately or cooked food eventually, let them have it. The moment we give to them, they eat, their bellies full, and being relieved of hunger, thirst, and poverty, they gain mental satisfaction. Their malicious thoughts and evil deeds are pacified. The altruistic intent of the awakening mind is born in their mind streams, and the two collections are perfected. Imagine that thereby their mind streams are imbued with the bliss of the perfect body of truth. So, converting our body into every possible thing that these beings need, from basic necessities to the body of a Buddha, we give it to them and they experience great satisfaction and bliss. Namkar Pal goes on, there's a verse that says, the result of help is happiness, and the fruit of harm is misery. See your condition as an example, and do not inflict harm on others. The same practice of giving should be repeated towards all beings in every direction. Think of giving your body, just as before, to every sentient being without exception, in the living worlds in the eastern direction as numerous as grains of sand in the Ganges River. Then give likewise to those in the other main and sub-directions. So now, once we've given to those who harm us, we open our mind to all beings everywhere and offer them whatever they need. Even though we have already given our transformed body to all those in the animal and human realms, we can start with the beings familiar to us in this world, the humans, the animals, fish, birds, and reptiles, and so on. Then we can include all the unseen beings of our world, even though we do not know what they're like, and then go further out to all the various beings of the universe and beyond. We give our transformed bodies to every single sentient being without leaving a single tiny one out. Now this quote concludes the section in the text on how to give to those not on the spiritual path. Namkar Pal now continues to describe how, in our development of love, to give to those on the spiritual path. Now, of course, talking about being on the spiritual path means particularly the Buddhist spiritual path, for I guess the ancients like Namkar Pal did not recognize other spiritual paths as valid. Does that mean we have to follow suit? I don't think so, for His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, if we do not appreciate other spiritual paths, we cannot really appreciate our own. So although the text is quite Buddhist specific, we might include the serious practitioners of other paths and wish that through what they're doing and our giving, they might be led to highest realizations. To continue with Nam Kau Pel, he says, make offerings to the practitioners of the low vehicle by transforming your body into wish-fulfilling forms which meet their needs. Imagine that each one provides the practitioner with perfections of the two collections, the complete causes and conditions, outer and inner, to actualize the state of Buddha, the transcendent subduer, in this very life, and that thereby they experience the bliss of the perfect body of truth in their mind streams. In like manner, offer your body to followers of a great vehicle, from those in the paths of accumulation and application, up to the great bodhisattvas on the 10th spiritual level. Think that they, too, obtain the bliss of the perfect body of truth in their mind streams through the perfection of the two collections. Now here, Nam Kau Pel gets a little bit pushy when he says, instead of giving those not on the Mahayana path the conditions to attain arhatship that they are aspiring to, we should give them the causes and conditions to become a Buddha instead. Does he assume that these practitioners actually do want to become Buddhas? Or does he sabotage their wish to become an arhat for his own desire for them to become Buddha? The assumption in the Mahayana tradition is, of course, that everybody should become Buddha regardless of their own mental dispositions. And while the Bodhisattva vow does encourage Bodhisattvas to urge practitioners to attain full Buddhahood, it may seem coercive to direct those on the path to becoming an arhat to follow the Mahayana instead. Did the Buddha do this? Or did he direct his disciples to those practices that best suited their minds? As we'll see in a short while, Shantideva suggests we give those on the path to becoming an arhat the peace of that state as they wish. Nam Kau Pel then goes on to tell us how to transform our body into offerings to spiritual teachers and Buddhas. He says, next, offer your body to your direct spiritual masters, those belonging to their lineage, and to the fully awakened residing in the infinite extensive worlds in the 10 directions. Imagine creating many bodies before each of them, and that these bodies have numerous arms and hands enabling us to offer innumerable prostrations, stimulated by an understanding of the advantages to be gained thereby due to the process of actions and results. Furthermore, imagine immense heaps of inconceivable offerings emanated from this wish-granting body, and that thereby a great uncontaminated peace is born in their mind streams. Then he quotes verses from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life again. May sentient beings repeatedly make offerings to all the Buddhas, and may they constantly possess the inconceivable bliss of the Buddhas. May Bodhisattvas fulfill the welfare of sentient beings as they wish to do, and may all living beings receive all that the Buddhas have intended for them. Similarly, may the solitary Buddhas and the hearers enjoy peace. So, we visualize all those on the spiritual path, both Theravada and Mahayana, and in our mind transform our body into everything that leads them to the state they wish for. But that's not enough. Thinking about our spiritual masters and all the fully realized beings, we mentally transform our body into everything they need as well, as wonderful offerings from ourselves. All this results in great peace and bliss arising in their minds. As Nam Kau Pel implies, to do this kind of practice, we need to understand why we do it. And that is mainly because, through the law of cause and effect, it will lead to much happiness in the future. Doing this kind of practice in which we hold on to nothing and give everything away creates a lot of positive potential in our mind streams and leads us to being able to actually do it in the future. Can we give our body away at this moment? Well, most of us will not be able to. We're so attached to this body that even a slight harm to it causes us to complain and become upset. Imagine some being coming up to you and saying, I need your arms, please give them to me. Now, a great bodhisattva might immediately give such a being an axe and say, there you go, they're all yours, chop away. But most of us have a long way to go before we get to that point. And that's okay. We might be a bodhisattva in training, so it's not appropriate at this time to actually give our body. Nevertheless, we can do so again and again in our mind, thus building up the wish and the capacity to be able to give everything, including our body, in the future. And this is just cause and effect in process. We are creating the causes now so that we will experience the results, the actual ability to give our body fully in the future. Maybe in this life, but much more likely in some probably distant life to come. Still, we can find inspiration in those who have given their bodies and lives for the sake of others. Here's the story of such a one, a Catholic priest who died in Auschwitz concentration camp during World War II. I've taken his story from the website auschwitz.dk, and it goes like this. The story begins on the 8th of January, 1894. Raymond Kolbe was born the second son of a poor weaver at Zunska Wola near Lodz in Poland. In his infancy, Raymond seems to have been normally mischievous. But one day, after his mother had scolded him for some mischief or the other, her words took effect and brought about a radical change in the child's behavior. Later, Raymond explained this change. That night, I asked the Mother of God what was to become of me. Then she came to me holding two crowns, one white, the other red. She asked if I was willing to accept either of these crowns. The white one meant I should persevere in purity, and the red that I should become a martyr. I said that I would accept them both. Thus early did the child believe and accept that he was destined for martyrdom. His belief in his dream colored all his future actions. In 1910, he became a Franciscan, taking the name Maximilian. He studied at Rome and was ordained in 1919. He returned to Poland and taught church history in a seminary. He built a friary just west of Warsaw, which eventually housed 762 Franciscans and printed 11 periodicals, one with a circulation of over a million, including a daily newspaper. In 1930, he went to Asia, where he founded friaries in Nagasaki and in India. In 1936, he was recalled to supervise the original friary near Warsaw. When Germany invaded Poland in 1939, he knew that the friary would be seized and sent most of the friars home. He was imprisoned briefly and then released and returned to the friary, where he and the other friars began to organize a shelter for 3,000 Polish refugees, among whom were 2,000 Jews. The friars shared everything they had with the refugees. They housed, fed, and clothed them, and brought all their machinery into use in their service. Inevitably, the community came under suspicion and was watched closely. Then, in May 1941, the friary was closed down, and Maximilian and four companions were taken to the death camp Auschwitz, where they worked with the other prisoners. One day, an SS officer found some of the heaviest planks he could lay hold of and personally loaded them onto the Franciscan's back, ordering him to run. When he collapsed, the SS officer kicked him in the stomach and face and had his men give him 50 lashes. When the priest lost consciousness, the Nazis threw him in the mud and left him for dead. But his companions managed to smuggle him to the camp infirmary, and there he recovered. The doctor, Rudolf Daim, later recalled, "I can say with certainty that during my 4 years in Auschwitz, I never saw such a sublime example of the love of God and one's neighbor." Prisoners at Auschwitz were slowly and systematically starved, and their pitiful rations were barely enough to sustain a child. One cup of imitation coffee in the morning, and weak soup and half a loaf of bread after work. When food was brought, everyone struggled to get his place and be sure of a portion. Father Maximilian Kolbe, however, stood aside in spite of the ravages of starvation, and frequently there would be none left for him. At other times, he shared his meager ration of soup or bread with others. In the harshness of the slaughterhouse, Father Kolbe maintained the gentleness of Christ. At night, he seldom would lie down to rest. He moved from bunk to bunk, saying, "I'm a Catholic priest. Can I do anything for you?" A prisoner later recalled how he and several others often crawled across the floor at night to be near the bed of Father Colby to make their confessions and ask for consolation. Father Colby pleaded with his fellow prisoners to forgive their persecutors and to overcome evil with good. When he was beaten by the guards, he never cried out. Instead, he prayed for his tormentors. A Protestant doctor who treated the patients in Block 12 later recalled how Father Colby waited until all the others had been treated before asking for help. He constantly sacrificed himself for the others. In order to discourage escapes, Auschwitz had a rule that if a man escaped, 10 men would be killed in retaliation. In July 1941, a man from Colby's bunker escaped. The dreadful irony of the story is that the escaped prisoner was later found drowned in a camp latrine, so the terrible reprisals had been exercised without cause. But the remaining men of the bunker were let out. "The fugitive has not been found," the Commandant Karl Freitsch screamed. "You will all pay for this. 10 of you will be locked in the starvation bunker without food or water until they die." The prisoners trembled in terror. A few days in this bunker without food and water, and a man's intestines dried up and his brain turned to fire. The 10 were selected, including Franciszek Gajownicek, imprisoned for helping the Polish resistance. He couldn't help a cry of anguish. "My poor wife," he sobbed. "My poor children, what will they do?" When he uttered this cry of dismay, Maximilian stepped silently forward, took off his cap and stood before the commandant and said, "I am a Catholic priest. Let me take his place. I am old. He has a wife and children." Astounded, the icy-faced Nazi commandant asked, "What does this Polish pig want?" Father Kolbe pointed with his hand to the condemned Franciszek Gajownicek and repeated, "I am a Catholic priest from Poland. I would like to take his place because he has a wife and children." Observers believed in horror that the commandant would be angered and would refuse the request or would order the death of both men. The commandant remained silent for a moment. What his thoughts were on being confronted by this brave priest, we have no idea. Amazingly, however, he acceded to the request. Apparently, the Nazi had more use for a young worker than for an old one and was happy to make the exchange. Franciszek Gajownicek was returned to the ranks and the priest took his place. Gajownicek later recalled, "I could only thank him with my eyes. I was stunned and could hardly grasp what was going on. The immensity of it. I, the condemned, am to live, and someone else willingly and voluntarily offers his life for me, a stranger. Is this some dream?" I was put back into my place without having had time to say anything to Maximilian Kolbe. I was saved, and I owe to him the fact that I could tell you all this. The news quickly spread all around the camp. It was the first and last time that such an incident happened in the whole history of Auschwitz. For a long time, I felt remorse when I thought of Maximilian. By allowing myself to be saved, I had signed his death warrant. But now, on reflection, I understood that a man like him could not have done otherwise. Perhaps he thought that as a priest, his place was beside the condemned men to help them keep hope. In fact, he was with them to the last. Father Colby was thrown down the stairs of Building 13 along with the other victims and simply left there to starve. Hunger and thirst soon gnawed at the men. Some drank their own urine. Others licked moisture on the dank walls. Maximilian Colby encouraged the others with prayers, psalms and meditations on the Passion of Christ. After 2 weeks, only 4 were alive. The cell was needed for more victims, and the camp executioner, a common criminal called Bock, came in and injected a lethal dose of carbolic acid into the left arm of each of the 4 dying men. Colby was the only one still fully conscious, and with a prayer on his lips, the last prisoner raised his arm for the executioner. His wait was over. We know this was how it happened because the executioner Bock later described it. You can read his description on the website but we don't have time to read it today. The story continues, "So it was that Father Maximilian Kolbe was executed on the 14th of August 1941 at the age of 47 years, a martyr of charity. The death certificate, as always made out with German precision, indicated the hour of death, 12:30. Father Kolbe's body was removed to the crematorium and without dignity or ceremony was disposed of like hundreds of thousands who'd gone before him and hundreds of thousands more who would follow. The heroism of Father Kolbe went echoing through Auschwitz. In that desert of hatred, he had sown love. A survivor, Joseph Stemmler, later recalled, "In the midst of a brutalization of thought, feeling, and words, such as had never before been known, man indeed became a ravening wolf in his relations with other men. And into this state of affairs came the heroic self-sacrifice of Father Kolbe." Another survivor, Jerzy Balicki, declared that Father Kolbe's death was a shock filled with hope, bringing new life and strength. It was like a powerful shaft of light in the darkness of the camp. The cell where Father Kolbe died is now a shrine. Maximilian Kolbe was beatified as confessor by Paul VI in 1970 and canonized as martyr by Pope John Paul II in 1981. But what happened to Gajanicek, the man Father Kolbe saved? He died on March the 13th, 1995, at Bzek in Poland, 95 years old and 53 years after Kolbe had saved him. But he was never to forget the ragged monk. After his release from Auschwitz, Gajanicek made his way back to his hometown with a dream of seeing his family again. He found his wife, but his two sons had been killed during the war. Every year on August the 14th, he went back to Auschwitz. He spent the next five decades paying homage to Father Kolbe, honoring the man who died on his behalf. Father Kolbe's incredible deed is an inspiration for all mankind. His life serves as a eulogy to the millions who perished in World War II. He did not leave his legacy as an ode to the past, rather as a beacon of hope to the future. That is, a beacon of hope for us who still have a long way to go before we can reach his state of selflessness. And now time is up and we must go. Please dedicate any positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thanks very much for being with us today, and I hope you will join us again next week. I also hope you have a wonderful and love-fulfilling week. Thanks again and goodbye.